Well, good evening, everyone. It's, I guess, a testimony to the complexity and the evolving study that I've been making of Moses. And as we, I think, mentioned back in July when we did Moses chapter 1, that we elected to divide the life of Moses into three sections, the first 40 years, the second 40 years, and the third 40 years. And it's quite remarkable, isn't it, that his life divides so neatly and so clearly in the text into these four periods of time. I'd like also to say, to begin with, that as we look at chapter 2 tonight, which is the second 40 years, and God willing, chapter 3 next week, the third 40 years, that these 40 years are also unique in that there's a little bit said about Moses at the beginning of the first 40 years. It's not much, you know, he's been in the bulrushes in the basket and the son of Pharaoh's daughter and his sister and all of that, but very little said about him. There's a little bit said about him at the end of the 40 years where he encounters the Egyptian and then he flees. So in the middle, there's really nothing said about him at all. The second 40 years, a little bit said about him at the beginning as he makes acquaintance with the Midianites, gets married, has a couple of sons, and then there's really nothing said about him at all until the very end of that period. Now, there was a fast transition from the last half a year or year of Moses' life in Midian and the beginning of the liberation of the nation of Israel, which is the beginning of the third 40 years. And then if we look at the texts from there on through Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, there's very little said about the center 40 years of the wilderness wanderings. Quite a bit said about the beginning, and a lot said at the end. Other than the fact that there were laws and rules and regulations in the tabernacle and all of that set out, which really applied more to the beginning of the 40 years. But these 40 years were notable in that there's very little said in the middle years. Now you might say, well, what does that mean? And is that important? And I guess as we look at these things, as I look at these things, I guess I find all sorts of things that are curious, but maybe not particularly important. But here we are, the first 40 years I had labeled as thinking he was somebody. I have the second 40 years labeled learning he was nobody, which is this evening. And the third 40 years next week, God willing, will be seeing what God can do with a nobody. And those are the three kind of, I think, simple sections, titles that would apply to these sections. Now, remember that he was a crown prince of Egypt. He was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. We know from Josephus and some other Jewish historians and from some internal textual evidence that, in fact, Moses was a commander of the Egyptian army, and he did conduct a number of conquests going to the east and also down into Ethiopia, where he, according to Josephus and some other commentators, historians, said that he conquered the Egyptian or the Ethiopians and brought home a Nubian wife. Now, we know that because we see a meter again in the third 40 years, and that's something for another evening. He comes back from towards the end of his life, possibly after the great conquest of the Ethiopians, and he decides, wonders never cease, to liberate the Hebrew slaves, whom by this time he had decided were his people. And we know that he had a little bit more insight, which we'll have a look at in a moment, God willing, than what it might appear in chapter 2. But he goes out to visit them, and he sees an Egyptian taskmaster harassing one of his brethren. And there was certainly no shortage of those in Egypt. But he takes exception to this, and he kills this individual, and buries him in the sand, which tells us a number of things about Moses at that particular point in time. Because, as Stephen says in Acts chapter 7, that he assumed that these people who had been in bondage for many years would want to be liberated. And that seems like a reasonable assumption. Well, we'll go down and liberate them. They're making bricks and they're getting tired of that, and this is a hard life for them, and they're my people. He assumed that they would want to be delivered. And it turns out that they didn't, which was kind of interesting, although it's not unusual either to the human spirit, because we ourselves are enslaved in Egypt. We're so used to it. We're so happy with it. We're so comfortable with it. And Egypt, if it was anything, was about choices, food and things, interesting things, and about a steady job, I guess. There was an allure, something compelling about Egypt, and they didn't want to be liberated. And this, I think, came as a bit of a shock to Moses, but in the course of doing this, we're told that he looked from side to side. He looked both ways. The NIV says he kind of glanced around like this before he killed the Egyptian to make sure nobody was watching. And of course, the big mistake he made, that while he looked to the left and he looked to the right and he maybe looked over his shoulder, he didn't look up. There was one direction he didn't look. And that really says a lot about the events as they started to unfold. He was pushed aside. Somebody said, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us?" And he thought he was eminently prepared for such a task. A crown prince of Egypt and a great military commander. Who would be better to lead the people of Israel, the Hebrews, out of bondage? He was dedicated to God's will, but not so much dedicated to God. He did things his own way, which is, you know, one of the things that we find easier to do too. Sort of figure it out our own way. And he was dedicated to the cause because in Exodus chapter 2, verse 14, he goes out again the next day. He was a bit concerned about what he'd done because he buries the Egyptian in the sand, so he wanted to kind of cover it up. But he goes out the next day, and I think this is a problem that people who have great talent and great opportunity and great ability, they push the margin even more. But it turns out he couldn't even deal with one tin pot Egyptian taskmaster. It was God who in the end actually buried the Egyptians. And we'll think about that, God willing, maybe a bit towards the end of this class. However, it was a self-life. It was what Moses was at the end of his first 40 years. And when the self-life, which we also get involved in, when it runs its course, and it does, hopefully, for most of us from time to time, these periods of our life run their course. And when they do, there's a well in the wilderness, a well of life that is near. And that is exactly where Moses finds himself, by the well. And when we get to the well in the wilderness, brothers and sisters, there are all sorts of new opportunities. They're often not the opportunities we might have imagined, but there are new opportunities. And if we reach the well in the correct state, then we will soon understand that those opportunities are, in fact, part of the will of God in our life. So, Moses leaves Egypt, and he arrives in the wilderness of, well, the wilderness. And I want to say at the outset, if you see in the notes under "to the desert, extending the time of preparation," that there's a comment made in Hebrews. And let's go to Hebrews chapter 11, because I think this is, in all fairness, a comment that we must at least look at briefly. There was a lot of faith in the life of Moses. So he had faith, and I think this is what the writer of the Hebrews is saying. Well, first of all, there was faith in Moses' parents. So we can assume that faith that put him in a basket in the river was a faith that he also understood from his mother when she had the opportunity to bring him home and actually wean him and prepare him for going finally to the courts of Pharaoh. By faith in verse 24, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, this was a decision that he obviously made towards the end of his life when he said, I don't care about the Ethiopians. I don't care about conquest. I don't care about being the prince of Egypt. I'm going to now cast my lot in with the people of God, as the writer to the Hebrews says, choosing to be mistreated, choosing to be aligned with a slave nation. What hope did that have? What future did that hold out for this a great Egyptian? He decided against the pleasures of sin for the season, the short time. He was looking at the longer picture. And he chooses the people of God and the disgrace of Christ. Now, this is interesting, too, because Moses clearly, according to the writer of the Hebrews, understood the messianic hope of Israel and the covenants of promise and what the future of Israel was. And we had this opportunity this last week on Monday to go down to this display that they had down in Quadra Street called Messiah's Mansion. They had a replica, full-size, full-scale replica of the tabernacle set up. And I was a little bit irritated that the Seventh-day Adventists had a hand in it because, well, our tour guide was taking us around. She mentioned the seventh day, the Sabbath, and I thought, okay, there's something here. But what we could clearly see as we listened to her talk, that they taught the tabernacle from Christ, and we teach Christ from the tabernacle. And there's a whole lot better perspective as we begin with the tabernacle and look forward to Christ. Moses clearly had that concept before the tabernacle and had it in his heart. So this is a tribute to Moses. It was his faith that he had when he left Egypt. It was faith also that led him across the Red Sea, but the text clearly indicates that the faith existed when he left Egypt. Now, little diversion here, and you know, sometimes in Bible classes we're kind of allowed to go sideways, I think, go like this. Yeah. Where was Midian? Now, I was told that Midian was in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula, and the Midianites were down there. And that Mount Sinai was down there in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the Bible doesn't say it was. There's no specific evidence that says that it was. As a matter of fact, there's quite a bit of evidence to suggest that it was in Arabia. As a matter of fact, there's more biblical evidence to say that it was in Arabia than there is that it was in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula. So where did we get this notion? Well, we got the notion that it was that mountain in the southern part of Sinai from Queen Helena, who was Constantine's mom. She was the one who designated all of these, they were tourist attractions, basically, in the Middle East, because that created a lot of business. She went through Jerusalem and other places and said, this is that, and that's the tomb, and that's, and so on, and it created big business. You know, many things never change because that's why the Dome of the Rock was built, because it was a draw by the Arabs to Jerusalem. So what do we know? Well, first of all, Midian was the son of Keturah. So Genesis chapter 25, verse 1 to 6, and also in 1 to 2, and also in verse 6. Abraham had lots of sons, including Ishmael and Midian Isaac. And we find out in Genesis chapter 25 that the Midianites, along with some of the other families of Abraham, were sent off to the east. And the text is quite specific about that. The Ishmaelites ended up there too. So if you were in Beersheba, down in the southern part of the land of Israel today, where Abraham was pretty much spent a lot of his life, if you went straight east, you'd go out through modern Jordan and straight into Arabia. So he didn't send them to the south. I guess that's what I'm saying. He sent them to the east. They were traders, basically, who crossed from east to west, from Arabia through to the highway that went north-south and then went down into Egypt and up into Syria and so on. So they were well-known nomadic traders, but their basic headquarters was in the land of Midian. They had a place. And they traded Joseph, as we know, Genesis chapter 37, verse 28. Moses, of course, finds himself in Midian and has a wife there, and there seems to be some relationship, immediate connection between Jethro and Moses. Moses orders the Midianites destroyed in Numbers 31, verse 1, towards the end of his 40 years. These weren't necessarily the people of his father-in-law, Jethro, but because Jethro seemed to be a wing of or a part of the Midianite family called the Kenites, but he doesn't seem to be, and I suspect he wasn't a part of the confrontation with Israel over Baal Peor in the wilderness. Gideon, of course, defeats Midian again. They were eastern peoples, it says in Numbers chapter 6, verse 3. Probably Arabia, says Encyclopedia Britannica and Holman Bible Dictionary and other sources. Now you might say, so what? I remember getting into trouble over this, and I've been in trouble before, but when I was a teenager back in the late 50s, and Brother Percy Mansfield was speaking at our old hall down on King's Road, and he had some pictures of Mount Sinai, the current Mount Sinai. And it was a really desolate place, rocky. Not a big mountain, a smaller mountain, and really a valley to one side of it that was pretty rugged. And he'd been there, and he'd walked up the mountain. And after I said to him, "That looks pretty rough there," I said, "How would you fit a million people in there?" Well, actually, it'd be, if we take the numbers the way they are, it'd be more than a million people. But how would you put a million people in that desolate, rocky little valley? He says, "Well, because the Bible says it does. Don't you believe the Bible?" And I said, "Well, I'm not. The fact is, it doesn't say it. So why do we even bother with it?" Well, I say this, brothers and sisters, because if this is true, and if Moses went actually to Arabia on the west shore of the Gulf, it would, the timing would be right, the distance would be fine, and so on. So that's not a problem. But it means that it put Moses and probably Paul, Galatians 1:17, in the land of the Arabian people, the famine, basically, and in the area very close to Mecca, a bit west of Mecca on the border of the Gulf. Which really, to me, enriches our whole understanding of these families and how they meshed and how that they were a constant problem to the people of Israel, the Ishmaelites, the Midianites, the Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, all people that were to the east of the land of Israel, and all people that they had to encounter as they came back into the land and crossed the sea. So here he is. He comes to the well, and he finds a wife, which is really what Jacob did before. He also intervenes in an injustice. The daughters of Jethro were there, and these brigands or pirates or raiders or bullies were harassing them. And so they were dealing with a prince of Egypt here, and he puts him to flight. And he ends up going home and having dinner with Jethro and marrying his daughter, possibly his oldest daughter. Now, the word Zipporah is interesting. And I have the whole history on this because we have a granddaughter named Zipporah, and our son's an historian, so he's got the whole thing about the word Zipporah. But it's not necessarily a Hebrew word. It was sort of adopted into the Hebrew as far as he understands it, and it means bird. And it's also feminine, so it means a female bird. But he also tells me that it has to do with small. This was a small female bird. He married, essentially, little lady bird. And I'm sure she was cute. And I'm sure that that's not the only reason why he married her, but she seemed to be a very, very worthy woman, and probably with a lot of understanding of where Moses had come from and what the connection to the family was. There's some argument that that the Midianites, especially Jethro's family, probably had quite an understanding of the God of Israel, even though it had been 400 years plus since the families had had much contact, as far as we know. He has two sons. The first one's name is Gershom, and that means stranger. He said that because he was a stranger in an alien land. That's why he called his son Stranger. And so he was, in fact, a stranger in Egypt. He was, in fact, a stranger in Midian. And he never would cease to be a stranger, because at the end of his life, he got to view the land from afar off. He was still in a foreign land, which is a remarkable piece of the account, really, of Moses. He had a second son named Eleazar. God is my helper. That's what that means. God helps. Moses said, he delivered me from the hand of Pharaoh. So he calls his, and you read about this in Exodus chapter 18, verse 4. So here he was, alone, being deprogrammed. I like that word because I think it's quite descriptive. Humbled, really. More sensitive to things. Useful to God. Learning he was a nobody. And God calls him, amazingly, to his original task. He assumed 40 years before that God would want him to deliver the Hebrews. And of course God did, but not then. God now calls him after 40 years to his original task. And I'm amazed at, always amazed at the text. You know, you just read the text and think, well, what was going on here? And chapter 3, verse 1 is so simple and plain and almost as if it's irrelevant to the whole text itself. It covers the whole period of his life. One sentence, and I imagine, you know, when I was thinking about this, that it might be if you, for example, went to your 40-year reunion of your high school reunion, and, you know, and all the guys are hanging around chatting about the last 40 years, and somebody says, so whatever happens to... Well, in my case, Dave English. And he was a dude, Dave English was. He was the valedictorian, and he was also the student council president. And I'd known him in junior high school. He was a student counselor, and he was also the house captain and a great athlete and a bright guy. And somebody says, wonder where he is. You know, he had this beautiful, tricked-out 57 Chevy that his dad bought for him, and he hung out with a beautiful black woman. And, you know, it's like, man, she was a screaming babe, right? Whatever happened to him? Didn't he win that contest, you know, that first prize was a one-week all-expense-paid trip to Prince George? And, somebody says, no, he came in second. And he said, yeah, well, that's right. Well, second prize was a two-week all-expense-paid trip to Prince George. And, well, what did he ever do? Well, I think he's a gardener. And somebody says, that's too funny. A gardener in Prince George? That's amazing. And that would have been probably what was going on at the 40th anniversary of the founding of the Nubian Dragoons. You could see them sitting around drinking their double ozone reverse treated osmotic River of Life Nile water and saying, whatever happened to Moses? Man, he was the guy who liberated and conquered Ethiopia, prince of Egypt. He had all these amazing campaigns, brought back that gorgeous Nubian princess. Oh, she was a babe. Wonder what ever happened to him. Oh, well, he went, and after he comes back from Ethiopia, he decides he's going to liberate the Hebrew slaves. And somebody says, that's amazing. That's too funny. And Pharaoh kicks him out. And what happened to him then? Well, somebody said he married a Midianite woman. A Midianite woman. And what's he doing now? Well, I think he's herding goats in Arabia. So he says, that's too funny. Herding goats in Arabia. And that's the way it was. You know, if you read this, chapter 3, verse 1, now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. What a job for the crown prince of Egypt. His father-in-law was a priest of Midian, so he married into wealth, I guess, some status. And he's just there with his herd in the backside of Horeb in Arabia. And he sees this bush burning. And so he wanders over there to see what was going on. I'll just go over there, he said, in chapter 3, and just see what this strange sight is. And then God calls to him and he says, Moses. The first time God had spoken to him. Moses, and Moses said, here am I. And he says, I am the God of your father Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And as Moses walks closer to the burning bush, God stops him and says, hold it. Don't come any closer. Take off your shoes. You're walking on holy ground. The crown prince of Egypt. And he hides his face because he's afraid of God. And he says, here I am, in verse 4. And then God said to him, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And hallelujah, brothers and sisters, not only was the bush burning, but the world was changing. Because God was about to liberate his people Israel. He was talking to his man now, finally, after 40 years. He was about to liberate his people Israel. He was about to bring about the greatest act of redemption in history that would ever be in history. He says later in Deuteronomy, he says, has any other nation been taken out of a nation like your nation is going to be formed and taken out of Egypt? It's never happened. But it's not only was his light-bearing nation going to be released and liberated from Egypt, but this light-bearing nation was now going to go forth into the rest of the world to witness to God's glory and to witness to the presence, the living, abiding presence of God to the earth. And not only that, he was going to fulfill the covenants to Abraham, because he'd told Abraham in chapter 15 of Genesis that his people were going to go down into this strange land, and after 400 years we're going to be released. So God was now moving to fulfill his covenant with Abraham. And he's going to go and take them back to the land of Abraham that was now deemed to be a land flowing with milk and honey. These people, even though they were wicked, Canaanites, Hivites, Ammonites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, were wicked people. And their iniquity had come to a fullness, and God had to go in and take them out and put his light-bearing nation into this land. It was nevertheless a well-developed country. It had roads and it had houses, it had cities, it had walls, it had vineyards, it had crops, it had people who were relatively sophisticated in terms of the organization of their societies. Apart from their Baal worship and some of their bad religious practices, they were a very well-organized, wealthy, prosperous people. They traded in olive oil and grain, and they did some manufacturing, and they were a very important group of people on the trade routes from Egypt up to Syria. Now, he says, I am sending you to Egypt. to bring my people, the Israelites, out, sending you to Pharaoh. And Moses, he hasn't quite got it yet. He says, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? This seemed quite incongruous to Moses now after 40 years, that he should go back to face the leadership of Egypt, which is what he had fled from before. And God says, well, you don't have to worry about this. You don't have to be afraid, because I'll go with you. We've got a deal. You go down there and do what I say, and I'll be with you. So you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to stand there and say, well, what have I got to offer here? What can I do? And so this will be a sign to you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people of Israel out of Egypt, you'll come back to this mountain. So when you come back to this mountain, you'll know that I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that I am the God of covenant, and I am the God of action, and I'll bring this people back, and you're going to come with them back to this mountain. Now, Moses had some real big problems, because he said, well, when I go down there and tell Pharaoh that the God of the Hebrews wants his people to go, that they might serve him in the wilderness, it's for sure he's going to say, so what's his name? Now, the reason for that is because if you flip the page over, I went on the internet and just, the source of all useful information. But I think we're pretty safe on some of this. The Egyptian gods. Now, there was a plethora of gods. I think that means a lot of gods in Egypt. There are gods for everything. And you've got a list here, just really a short list of Egyptian gods. The god of the sun, god of music, god of destruction, god of the sky, Nut, he's called. Earth, dead, Osiris. And the big gods in Egypt were Osiris and Horus and Isis. Those were the kind of the trinity of gods in Egypt. But there are all kinds of lesser gods. And the god of Pharaoh was Horus. He was the big guy god. Magic, Isis, wisdom, embalming. They had a god for embalming. And Mat and Amun and Bastet and so on. They all had their little thing that they did. And this is really, and they all had their little icons and so on. And this is all part of Egyptian history. The fact is, brothers and sisters, that idolatry is a very compelling thing, because we like to fantasize about our idols. That's why we have them. We create them, and then we fantasize about them, and we kind of work with them in our minds. Because the good thing about it, the compelling thing about it, is that we can manipulate them, right? We can create idols the way we want to create them. And Isaiah said that. You know, you go into the woods and you cut down a tree and you carve it up and you put some jewels on it and some metal, and then you say, well, this is a great idol, and then you worship it, and then you take the rest of it and burn it in a fire to keep yourself warm. But Isaiah said, they have eyes, but they don't see. They have ears, but they don't hear. They have mouths, and people made them, and they were pretty good pieces of art, I guess. But they couldn't speak. They had heads, but there was no brains. And that was true of the gods of Egypt. And if there was one big underlying lesson that had to be painfully displayed, not only to the Egyptians, but to the Israelites as well, and that was that this God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was an eternal God. He was a God of covenant, and he was a God who did, who has, who would, and will. It's simple stuff. What do I tell him your name is? And God said, well, tell him I am sent you. Now, you know, we like to do theology too. We like to make stuff up, but that's really what he said. He said, tell him I am sent. What else could he say? God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, I might not make that connection in terms of, well, that's just, you know, Pharaoh has a God too. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Tell him I am sent you. And in saying that, there was this enormous concept suddenly presented. Because in the Hebrew, we know that I am is also I will. It encompasses that. This was the God who had and would and will. This was the eternal creator God who did things and who had to confront all of the gods of Egypt through a series of plagues. And finally, as we'll see, I think it's in chapter 6, and I've got it down here somewhere, that he had to deal with all the gods of Egypt. That's what happened at the end of the day. And one of them that was specifically mentioned was this god Baal-zephon. And Baal means Lord. They had lots of Baals or Baals in that area. But it also seems to mean the Lord of the North and of the Sea. That those two ideas seem to be invoked in the god Baal-zephon. Now, Baal-zephon was not the prominent god. He's not listed on our list here, but he was in fact the god who was supposed to protect the waters, the oceans at the north of Egypt, and from northern invasions. So that was his territory. That was his job. He had eyes, he had ears, he had a mouth, and he had a head. And he was there on the edge of the water that the Israelites crossed as a little town there. And evidently this image, the statue, was there. And so they needed a name. They had to have a name. And at the end of the day, of course, the final confrontation would be against Baal-zephon, who didn't hear, who didn't know, who didn't see, didn't hear, and so on. And he was defeated along with his armies in the Red Sea. So there had to be a name, and that name was the name of the eternal God, who's self-existent, who knows everything, and is the creator, and is the covenant keeper, primarily because he's true, but he's also eternal. And he's now moving with his man. And Moses is kind of standing there going, well, too. And Moses said, what do you got in your hand? He said, it's a shepherd's stick. So throw it on the ground. So he throws it on the ground. It turns into a snake. It's kind of a bit shocking. And so then God says, no, pick it up. Which was really a warm-up, more than anything. It was a warm-up to say that, well, whatever you've got in your hand, brethren and sisters, however insignificant it is what you have in your hand, God can use it. God will turn it into a miracle and turn it into power within our hands. Put your hand into your cloak, kind of the Napoleonic posture. Now pull it out. It was covered with leprosy. Now put it back in, and it came out as clean as a child's. God can heal the hands that possess the things that we need, that he will empower to bring about works of salvation. I don't think I'm getting out of line when I say that, because I think that's essentially the lesson that Moses was learning, and it's a lesson that we need to know. So then he says, well, I can't, I'm a person of faltering lips. And he actually says this a couple of times. Don't send me down there. I don't know how to talk. Well, he'd been out in the desert for 40 years, right? In Midian, he hadn't done too much talking. He did a lot of talking when he was back in Egypt, because he knew, as we have there in the last bullet under this section, that Moses would be up against some good talkers in Egypt, because these wizards and mediums and magic men in Egypt, they had a good line. And Moses knew that because he came from that school and all the wisdom of the Egyptians. So he knew all about that. And Moses said, I can't begin to do that job. And God said in chapter 4, verse 11, who gave you the mouth? Excuse me, who gave you the mouth? Don't stand there and say you can't, your mouth's no good. I created it. I gave you the mouth. And by the way, if you have a problem, I'll put words into your mouth. And as Moses protested, his anger, God's anger, burns against him in verse 14. It was like he's getting a little frustrated with this. And while he was still speaking to Moses about this, saying, okay, well, I'll tell you something. Right now, your brother Aaron's on his way. He's already on his way. He's left Egypt, and he's on his way. And you're going to see him in a couple of days. He's going to show up, and I'm going to let Aaron speak for you. And I'll help both of you. And actually, if we carefully read, I think, and I spent some time on this, it might be wrong, but it wasn't until the seventh plague that Moses actually started to speak up. Moses sort of started to take over, I think in chapter 7 of Exodus, when we got to the seventh plague, and Aaron sort of went into the background a bit. And from then on, Moses was in control, and through the Red Sea and up to Sinai. Moses was in control. But his brother was on the way to help. I'll help you both, he said. And this word I am, of course, is found most in this particular way in the book of Exodus. It's found 15 more times in chapter 6. It's found again in chapter 14. And this was clearly, and we'll have a look at this a little bit more as we proceed here, this was clearly an indication of the God of action. Now, some lessons learned, just in the sidebar. The old man, God's will, his way. That was the old Moses, 40 years ago. His sense of justice was correct. No problem with that. His impetuosity, I like that word too, was not correct. Because he assumed he was going to do this on his own. He had no legal authority to proceed to kill the Egyptian or to free the Hebrew slaves. God hadn't called him to do that. He just assumed. And his own conscience, as we see, was in conflict as he looked both ways and finally, buried the Egyptian in the sand. He immediately intervened when he got to Midian. He had this sense of justice, chased off the bandits and saved the girls and watered their flocks at the well that God was providing. And Moses, of course, in the end became synonymous. The term Moses, the name Moses, becomes synonymous with the rule of justice and law. What other laws, what other nation had such laws, he says in Deuteronomy, as you have? The new man was God's will, God's way. Here I am, he said, chapter 3, verse 4. He hides his face in humility and fear. Who am I, he says. His name, what shall I tell him? I need information. I've never been eloquent, he says. I'm slow of speech and tongue. This is a very, very different Moses than the man who left Egypt 40 years before. He was now ready for the calling of God. He clearly wasn't before. Send someone else, please. All the prophets really said that, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. It was the words of the true prophets of God. Uncircumcised lips, he said. This is interesting. Chapter 6, verse 27. And then, when I said, I think he started to speak up around chapter 7 and the seventh plague, it was from then on, just as the Lord commanded. And this phrase is repeated over and over again as we move through into chapter 14 and the liberation of the nation. It was just as the Lord commanded. He was now in full agreement and fully in tune and in sync with his God. God and his friend now in league, working out his great purpose. By this time, of course, the nation was ready to be saved. They had 40 more years of punishment, sheer punishment. And they're ready for deliverance. They weren't ready before. They didn't want to be saved. Now they wanted deliverance. Now when we think of the great I Am, the God who would, the eternal God who would, we see a number of words that come up in chapter 3, in verse 7. And just look at them here. It says in chapter 3, verse 7, God sees. Well, this is a direct challenge to the gods of the nations. God hears. He has eyes, but his eyes see. He has ears. His ears hear. God knows. He's concerned, says the NIV. God knows, and this is an intimate kind of a word. God cares, he's concerned. What other God could see, could hear, could know, and actually be concerned or show any type of concern for his people? Or, in verse 8 of chapter 3, would come down to rescue. Wow, That is absolutely amazing. I am, he says, fulfilling the covenant that he made to Abraham 400 years before. You'll come out of this land. In chapter 15. And verse 13 to 15 of chapter 15. Also, chapter 3, verse 12, God sends. It is God who says, I will, and he did. These are all action things that God was capable of doing, and he would do, not because his nation was a particularly righteous nation, and Moses mentions this later, we'll see next week, God willing, not because he was particular, but because of his covenant. Because he said, I've made a deal with Abraham, you are my land, and my people, and I'm going to put you in my land. That's why he was going to do it. And he would, and he did. The gods of Egypt, lastly in this section, didn't, they never did, and they never could, and they never would. Hallelujah. Our God saves, hears, knows, and sees. And rescues and redeems his people. Now, a curious little episode in the life of Moses, which we have to sort of look at before we sort of conclude with this. Moses was in trouble with God in chapter 4, verse 22 to 23. They packed up and they went home, went back to Egypt. Moses and his wife, his family, his brother Aaron, and they're going along this highway, and we have to understand that these roads that went east and west and north and south came with, well, not Holiday Inns, but they came with places to stay all along these roads. And these roads are known in history to go back thousands of years, and the ruins of them are along these roads that are still there. So you could stop in and stay the night, and that's what they were doing. And God almost kills Moses. I used to read this in our doing the readings, right? And I'm going like, how come God want to kill Moses? I couldn't figure that one out. And I'm not saying I'm standing here tonight explaining this all to you, but I do know this, and I think we can take this out of the text, that God had said that he was going to take the firstborn son of Egypt. And he wanted the Egyptians to let his firstborn son go, his covenant people, his firstborn son. And Moses wasn't going to do that, so he said, what I'm going to do, if you don't let my son go, I'm going to kill your firstborn son. I think the text implies that Moses' son wasn't circumcised. And that's what is, he didn't do it. I don't know whether he didn't have the guts to do it. I couldn't circumcise my son. I mean, I just... quite beyond me. But his wife did, Zipporah did. And she calls him basically a bridegroom of blood. And she had no idea how much blood was going to be shed at this point in time. But I think that is more a statement about Zipporah and a little lapse for Moses. Couldn't have been unaware. Couldn't have been taking his son back to liberate the covenant people, the circumcised covenant people, when his own son wasn't circumcised. Anyway, over the page. Pharaoh says, who's this Lord that I should obey him? He had all kinds of gods, right? But people are always coming in saying, well, the God of the Nile, the God of the Lord, do this to you or do that to you. Who is this, the Lord? Who is this I am that I should obey him? And Moses loses his shyness in chapter 7, and then he's moving from then on. He starts talking. And Exodus chapter 12 and 12, let's just have a quick look at that. Because this is what the, and we're not going to spend any time going through the ten plagues. On that same night I will pass, this is talking about the Passover now. That same night I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. That's what it was all about. By the time these people crossed that ocean and that waterway, and the Egyptian army was dead and drowned on the shore, every god of Israel of Egypt had to be humiliated and destroyed. And that's what happened. There's a little drama, of course, as they were trapped at the sea. And Pharaoh said, Bale's ephone will get them. They're wandering around, he said. They've lost touch of where they're going. They should have been heading east. They're going north, and they're going around. And Pharaoh had a little time to get his army together, what was left of it, sorted out, and get his horses and chariots heading towards the Israelites, the Hebrews, who were now trapped, it says, for chapter 14, verse 3, trapped by the sea. And they were terrified. And their immediate thought was, why did you bring us out of Egypt? We're just, now we're trapped. Are you going to bring us out here to die out in the wilderness? And there was this sarcasm, which is everywhere in Scripture, by the way. They said, aren't there enough graves in Egypt? We know that 60% of the whole territory of Egypt had been expropriated for tombs and burial spots. This was the land of the dead. And they were now heading to the land of the living. Moses answered the people and said, don't be afraid. Stand firm and you will see the deliverance of the Lord that he will bring you today. The Lord will fight for you. Just be quiet, he said. Sit still and be quiet. And finally, let's have a look at Exodus chapter 15. Exodus chapter 15 is really worth a read over and over because it gives you an insight into where Moses was. The enemy, verse 9, boasted. He said, I will pursue, Pharaoh said. We'll just get the army together and we'll chase them up, and Baal's ephon will keep them there in the gulf of the sea there, and we'll overtake them and we'll divide the spoils. Gorge myself on them. Draw my sword and my hand will destroy them. But you, says Moses, you, the great I am, blew with your breath and the sea covered them. It opened it up and covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Beautiful description. Who among the gods is like you, O Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders? You stretched out your right hand and the earth swallowed them up. In your unfailing love, you will lead the people you have redeemed. And God willing, next week we'll have a look at how he begins to lead his people.